President Wharton, members of the Board of Trustees, ladies and gentlemen. I work as Coordinator of Community Relations for Michigan State in the Grand Rapids office, and it appears that I am the only one from an off-campus extension center. I would like to preface my remarks by calling your attention to a report to the Provost of Michigan State University from the Committee on Education for Women, dated July 1961. I would like to begin by reading several excerpts from Chapter 7 on Continuing Education for Women and the Summary of Recommendations on Continuing Education for Women from Chapter 8 of this 90 pages plus report. And I quote, "Throughout recent research literature, conference proceedings, speeches and writings about modern American women, there is constant emphasis upon women's need for educational opportunities geared to a different time schedule than that which is functional for most men. Early marriage, inadequate financial resources, and family problems increasingly have caused women students to withdraw from college before graduation. For the past decade and a half, however, more and more of these women have considered their withdrawals as interruptions of education rather than terminations. Also, many women who receive degrees before leaving school are discovering that they need further education to reenter the occupation for which they were educated, but in which their participation was interrupted by marriage and child rearing. Furthermore, young mothers increasingly are recognizing that further education brings personal development satisfactions that otherwise often are missing during the early years of homemaking and child rearing. Finally, women's participation in civic and community enterprises is leading many to desire further education related to their specific individual endeavors in these areas. For long years, Michigan State University has been nationally recognized for the amount and quality of its extension work and provisions for continuing education. The committee believes, however, that neither these activities nor the regular academic offerings of the university can provide adequate educational opportunities for mature women unless the university develops a plan which realistically takes into account the characteristic problems peculiar to such women. The committee finds much evidence that numbers of mature women all over the United States desire educational opportunities particularly suited to the characteristic discontinuities of their lives. Furthermore, the committee believes that there is need for Michigan State University to develop a plan which will provide Michigan women and wives of resident students with such opportunities. Evidence of this need is provided by A, the committee's survey questionnaire, B, discussions with a variety of mature Michigan women, and C, analysis of the implications of the large number of student wives resident on campus. Most regular college programs are tailored to the needs and patterns of young people, and the administrative officers of these institutions, busy finding places and faculty for their expanding enrollments, are generally unconcerned or unable to give the advice that these women should have concerning the relative merits for their purposes of the pursuit of graduate or professional education, refresher study, or some of the variety of adult education opportunities available. Other guidance resources for adults are limited and tend to emphasize the vocational interests of men. In the state of Michigan, the greater Lansing area, and on the university campus, there are many women who desire, for one reason or another, to continue or expand their educational experiences. The characteristic discontinuities and demands of these women's lives, however, often make it impossible or extremely difficult for them to take advantage of the offerings of a university organized primarily to educate young undergraduates or graduates intent upon traditional professional preparation. The committee believes there is local and statewide need for a carefully coordinated plan to provide some form of continuing education for mature women who A, desire to re-enter the labor force but need to be brought up to date in their occupational fields, B, want intellectual stimulation as they concentrate on homemaking and child rearing, C, C, wish to fill the need for well-trained, semi-professional volunteers in hospitals, schools, and cultural and social agencies. D, desire to enhance their ability as participants or leaders in civic and community affairs. And E, want surely to become more liberally and fully educated human beings. This belief leads the committee to recommend that Michigan State University establish, under the direction of the provost, a plan of continuing education for women which encompasses the coordinating, planning, informational, and advising functions essential to effective education for mature women. End of quote. To implement these recommendations, the committee then recommended that one, and I won't repeat one since it's a repetition of the italicized remark, two, the provost appoint a coordinator vested with complete authority to carry out the four functions of the plan. Three, the coordinator be provided with staff assistance needed to carry out the functions of the plan, with special emphasis on advisors who have sole responsibility for working with participating women. Four, the provost, in consultation with the coordinator, appoint a committee representing appropriate units of the university to assist in planning and to advise on overall problems pursuant to establishing and carrying on the plan. Five, the coordinator place special emphasis on continuous attention to the educational needs of resident wives of married students. At this point, let me note that while implementation of other sections of the 1961 report from which I am quoting have taken place, these implementations have been directed toward the campus-based undergraduate woman student. Very little has been done for the mature woman student, especially if she does not live within the immediate East Lansing vicinity. I would like now to direct your attention to the present. 3 months ago, on November 18th, under the leadership of the Grand Rapids Continuing Education Center of Michigan State, and in collaboration with Aquinas College located in Grand Rapids, a highly successful conference on women took place. Entitled The Changing Consciousness of American Women, and utilizing resources of five of the state's major universities, the conference attracted over 400 women from all over Western Michigan. Over 70 women were turned away because of lack of space. While the size of the conference turnout itself was a surprise, a further surprise was contained in the geographic distribution. Nearly 26% came from towns and communities located from 10 to 90 miles from Grand Rapids. Women came from as far north as Big Rapids, from as far south as Albion and Kalamazoo, from as far west as South Haven, and as far east as East Lansing itself. The purpose of the conference was to administer a questionnaire to obtain data on the need for a woman's guidance and counseling center in Grand Rapids, and then to utilize the data to set one up. 346 of the women in attendance filled out and returned the questionnaire. While the report is not yet complete, certain needs have been identified which bear directly on the findings of the recent Commission on Admissions and Student Body Composition. One, the recognition of education as a lifelong process that ought to be accessible to one regardless of geographic location. Two, an indication of need for renewal and upgrading through personal and/or professional growth programs. Three, a tremendous need for evaluative counseling that would help women point themselves in the right direction. An overwhelming number of questionnaires were characterized by a profound sense of drift. No sense of planfulness or even how and where to begin was evidenced. One woman summed it all up in these two sentences, and I quote, "Help for women in her middle years is limited. How do we put our abilities and interests to their best and most rewarding use? And is there a need for us?" I would like to conclude my remarks with a reference again to the 1961 report on continuing education for women. This report identified the same needs and concerns of mature women the recently administered questionnaire identified. The recommendations of the 1961 report for mature women are the same as those contained in the 1971 report on admissions and student body composition. Nothing has changed, but 10 years have elapsed. This raises serious questions, inasmuch as it would appear the university is being challenged by its own publications to get with it. What is necessary to bring about implementation of the 1961 report charges to the provost? Other than my salary paid through continuing education, no other financial or supportive services are currently available from the university for development of programs for women or for implementation in an off-campus setting of recommendations contained in the 1961 report. Even the funding of the questionnaire just administered had to be sought through a private local foundation. What we perceive as needed, and the questionnaire verifies, is an interinstitutional, interagency concept resting on a community base that would serve as a two-way reference point and clearinghouse for coordinating women's needs and concerns with community needs and concerns. Because of unexpected national publicity, inquiries about the conference itself and the setting out of which it arose, namely community relations, questions have been directed to us for which we have no answers. I have a number of these letters here today if any of you are interested to see them. Events are moving. They cannot be stopped. But we are in no position to respond to the demands being placed on us. I would like to leave you with this question. How can the university respond quickly to maintain the momentum that has been generated and meet the needs of the raw nerve so obviously touched?
Thank you. Trustee Carrigan.
I would like to express the hope that Mrs. Levin's testimony will be transmitted to the Task Force on Lifelong Education, because I think this is the kind of input that can be extremely valuable, and I hope she will be willing to keep in touch with that. As a matter of fact, I wonder if it's appropriate to ask whether you might provide copies to President Wharton's office and perhaps to the board of your report when you do have all your data analyzed.
I would be glad to do this. Again, staff limitations are the reason that we are so slow in getting it completed.
I think that would be very much appreciated and very worthwhile for us to have.
All right.
Any other questions or comments? If not, thank you very much. Next, we have Dr. Eudora Pettigrew, who is an associate professor in the Center for Urban Affairs in the College of Education and is also a member of the Michigan Women's Commission.
President Wharton and members of the Board of Trustees of Michigan State University, and ladies and gentlemen, the Michigan's Women's Commission was established by the Michigan Legislature of 1968 as an independent unit of the Executive Office of the Governor to stimulate and encourage study and review of the status of women in Michigan. Members appointed by the Governor serve voluntarily for three-year terms. Heads of the State Departments of Civil Service, Education, Labor, and Social Services are ex officio members. The legislative body of 1968 delineated two specific assignments for the commission. One, to study the critical problems women face in education, employment, health, family relations, law enforcement, and civil and political rights. And two, to secure appropriate recognition of the abilities of women and their contributions to the state of Michigan. The Commission defines and studies current issues and problems. It refers problems to appropriate governmental agencies or private groups for further study, information, and/or action. The Commission initiates legislation and takes action in support of or opposition to proposed legislation. The Commission keeps the public informed through press releases, public meetings, personal appearances, and publications. It also serves as a resource for information on matters of concern to women, And finally, it identifies and recommends qualified women for appointment to governmental boards and commissions. The members of the commission, collectively and individually, support the elimination of discrimination based upon sex and or race in all levels and functions of education. Further, the commission strongly recommends that equal opportunity for women in employment, education, and comparable training programs be visibly supported by institutions of higher education. To facilitate the above goals, the Michigan Women's Commission presents the following specific recommendations for your study, consideration, and action. First, admission commissions of institutions of higher education should review their policies on women and seek to increase the numbers of women admitted to degree programs in all academic fields. Historically, university curriculums and our research have not encouraged inquiry into the discrimination in education, employment, and civil and political rights of women. Therefore, curriculum changes and or development should focus on the acquisition of data about legislative and employment practices that have perpetuated discrimination against all women, urban, suburban, and rural, and propose solutions to alleviate discriminative conditions. Such a curriculum effort could be generated and conducted through the efforts of academic units such as the School of Law, the College of Medicine, and the proposed College of Urban Affairs, as well as other units. Counselor training and education should develop the counseling skills necessary to steer women into all academic fields of endeavor rather than the traditional ones of education, nursing, and home economics. Opportunities in training and or education for women who wish to re-enter the employment world or develop their own potential as a member of human society should be increased and supported. Child care facilities should be increased to provide for the needs of women faculty and staff as well as the labor force. Working conditions and side benefits for women faculty, staff, and labor force should be equal to that for males. Equal pay and equal promotion policies should be instituted for all women faculty and staff as well as for the labor force. Administrative positions for women should be made available in all four divisions of the institution as well as in various academic units. Finally, the Commission recommends to you all of the statements presented here today from all women's groups as well as individuals for your study, consideration, and most importantly, action.
Thank you. Are there any questions, comments? Trustee Huff?
I don't have a question, Professor Pettigrew. I'd like to carry on a little conversation with you. You know, we up at this table, with the exception of the president, are political animals. We run for election, and sometimes we get elected, and sometimes we don't. A great many of these goals, it seems to me, that we've been talking about today, and I should ask you, have you been here for most of the proceedings?
I've been here almost 2 years.
A great many of these goals, it seems to me, might well be achieved through political action, and I have a feeling that we're maybe on the verge of some kind of political action in this state with a direct primary in my own party. I don't know your party, but in my own party, we, I think, are really going to name half our delegates to the National Convention this year as women, and I would hope that some of these actions in the social field, in the educational field, the speaker that just preceded you outlined a program and pointed up the difficulties of funding. We haven't brought this up much, but many of the things that have been recommended here today, they would really give us problems in the budget. And they are problems. Now, this is no excuse. I don't accept it as an excuse, but nevertheless, money is a problem. It just seems to me that women's organizations, women's spokesmen, women leadership have got to make their presence felt in the political arena also, along with the things that this university can do. Now, that isn't to brush off the things that we should do that we can do.
I would like to respond to that, sir. I think that what you are saying has some validity. And certainly the political movements among women these days, since we do happen to represent 51% of the voters, is going to have some effect upon what legislative actions are passed in various legislative bodies. However, I do not see that as an answer to the responsibilities that governing bodies of institutions such as this bear in this problem.
Well, it has an implication in this regard. After all, we have to make a presentation to the legislature. And if we did establish, for instance, as several speakers have proposed, a division whose chief purpose was to address the problems of women, personnel are a major problem. Nearly every speaker has emphasized the need for counseling. This translates into money, and money translates into a request to the legislature. And the legislature, at least up to this point, hasn't been terribly responsive to those kinds of appeals.
Well, perhaps the legislature might be more responsive if they felt they were getting a great deal of insistence from the governing people who determine the policies at institutions of higher education.
And from the electorate.
Correct.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much, Dr. Pettigrew. Next, we have a group from the Association of Women Students. First, Jeannie Fry.
First of all, let me state that I am a graduate student and would like to go on record as such. President Wharton, members of the Board of Trustees, there exists on campus no woman, no office, no committee that has begun to realize, or more importantly, has dealt with the problems of women students at Michigan State University. Women students are continually facing discrimination, both overtly and covertly, and no service is enclosed in the university structure to deal with these problems. An Office of Women's Advocate needs to be established immediately. To point out the need for such a position, let me enumerate on some of the discriminatory practices with which women must deal in this collegiate institution. I have suggested that these practices exist overtly and covertly. Let me use these two categories to elaborate a few of the discrepancies that exist. As far as overt discriminatory practices are concerned, let me give you five examples. First of all, let me point to a very obvious lack of someone or something to deal with the problems of all women students. To whom do women turn with their grievances? What exists to ensure communication among the various women's groups on campus so that they may benefit from each other? Who knows the grievances that women students have? Who communicates these problems to the administration, faculty, trustees? No one, and nothing exists. Second, there exists on this campus no women's center. There is also no effort for continuing education for women to provide assistance to mature women for education, re-education, and/or retraining for additional social mobility. The range of these services could include counseling and advisement, personal assessment, daycare centers, and placement and counseling and assistance. Also absent are programs on campus in the form of symposiums and seminars to educate women students about their own potential. Third, women's athletic teams compete in 7 varsity sports, yet lack adequate funding for travel, coaching expenses, equipment, uniforms, and so on. For example, recently the women's volleyball team lacked funding to compete in national competition. The coach paid for the expense of the team, and while there have evidently been gestures for reimbursement, it is still unclear whether or not she has, in fact, received such funds. Nothing or no one existed to help her handle the inequity she was faced with. Fourth, what are the statistics on admissions? Some progress is being made in the area of admissions. However, the number of women students admitted this past fall indicates that there is still progress to be made. For example, women only make up 30% of the total graduate student population. A review needs to be made of the efforts of the admissions office in terms of recruitment practices, literature that students are receiving in the mail, and so on. Who exists or what exists to ensure that such a review will be undertaken and carried out? 5. Of the women and women students on faculty committees, how many are on the policy-making committees, and how many are on those committees which make the decisions? I cannot answer this question specifically, but perhaps if the right person or right place existed, it could be answered and dealt with. As far as covert discriminatory practices are concerned, let me give you two examples. First, nothing exists on campus to help women deal with the subtle discrimination that occurs in academic advising and counseling. Advising which counsels a perfectly capable female out of a traditional career into one that is stereotyped is poor advising. The admissions report states in regard to advising, quote, special efforts should be made to provide women students with advisors well equipped by experience and interest to help them fully explore the increasingly broad range of educational and career alternatives to women, end of quote. Are such efforts being made? What about the capable woman that is advised out of veterinary medicine into nursing? What about the above average woman that is counseled out of the field of packaging because it is just not a woman's field? Such advising is poor. Who is available to prevent such inequities? Who is available to hear complaints about such problems? No one. Such advising must be rectified as the quality of counseling provided at the college level, needless to say, affects a woman's preparation for a vocational, social, and personal role in society. Studies show that early encouragement and definition influences careers of women. Secondly, who is available to help women cope with the lack of encouragement or, worse yet, the ignoring of women students that occurs not only in advising but in classes? Men often receive the encouragement while women are given little or no encouragement. Along these lines, what about the treatment in class that a woman must put up with, such as the remarks from a professor concerning women? Certainly, the expectations and the environmental press placed upon women students affects their performance, self-concept, and career goals. Who exists or what structure exists to help her cope with these things? Who or what exists to make the administration, faculty, and Board of Trustees aware of such practices? Perhaps each one of these examples alone seems rather insignificant, yet the accumulation of these things adds up to one thing, institutionalized sexism. Things which say to women, you are unimportant, you do not belong here, you're not really serious about your education, and so on. I find it sad that an institution of this size and caliber has no woman and no office to deal with the things that women face. Both the offices of the Ombudsman and the Equal Opportunities Programs Office are lacking the flexibility and are incapable of taking the action and initiative that needs to be taken. Michigan State University needs a women's advocate to provide help where women students on this campus are concerned. Such a woman could represent all women students in at least the following ways. 1. Help women deal with the discrimination that they face on campus. This can be done by the office and the women of this office being there for women to air complaints so that action can be enacted and so that grievances procedures can be explained. It could act as a referral agency. It should serve as a resource center also. This can also be done by the Office of the Women's Advocate, serving as a liaison between women students and the faculty and administration to make them aware of the concerns and problems that women students are faced with. Today's Board of Trustees session is obvious of the lack and need of something to speak to the needs of women students. If such an office existed, there would have been continuous input into the faculty and administration and Board of Trustees by the Women's Advocate, and the things that women face and want on this campus would have already been made known to them. And because of the nature of the Women's Advocate Office, not only would the university have been aware of these needs and concerns, but action could have been taken to see that these could have been met. The Office of the Women's Advocate could also serve as a women's center and could develop programs on campus, or at least see that such programs are developed to meet the needs of all women students. Secondly, she could help increase communication where the office could help increase communication between women students and all women's groups on campus. The advocate at Michigan State University must not only represent women students, but also provide increased communication among all women's groups on campus so that they may benefit from each other. Getting it together in 1972 cannot be accomplished by a committee, task force, or similar group of people, but can be and must be accomplished by a women's advocate office. Despite its organizational structure, few complex institutions of higher education are geared to handle the diversity of problems it generates for women students. This institution is no exception. All genuine concerns are not being resolved in the existing network of services in this university. In addition, women students are becoming increasingly aware of their rights and of the discrimination that is taking place in this university community, both overtly and covertly. With their increasing awareness, it is important that an Office of Women's Advocate be established within the university structure and that it is funded and supported by the university, yet allows the incumbent to do the things that must be done for women students. Such an office obviously demands time on the part of women, and such a person serving as the Women's Advocate should be one that is cognizant of women's problems, women's issues, the university environment, and is desirous of devoting the time and effort to the things that need to be done. This demands support from the university, not only through adequate funding, but also by granting the advocate access to all university offices in order to get through the red tape quickly. But because of the task at hand and the nature of her job, more than a women's advocate must exist. An office of the women's advocate is needed to support the advocate and give her help that she needs. I've tried to mention here some of the examples of overt and covert discrimination that women students face on this campus. More examples could be cited. In many cases, specific data is impossible to give. Nonetheless, these are real things that women on this campus are concerned about and deal with. I have also tried to show some of the ways that an Office of Women's Advocate could deal with the concerns and needs of women students. Women at Michigan State University need an Office of Women's Advocate now.
Thank you. Are there any questions or comments? Thank you very much. Next, we have Carolyn Voss.
President Wharton, members of the Board of Trustees. As a member of the Associated Women Students, I would like to speak to the existing problems and the inequities of intercollegiate athletics of women on the Michigan State University campus. Historically, there has been no place for women in the National Collegiate Athletic Association. Until recently, as stated in the Chronicle for Higher Education on January 17, 1972, the NCAA has not made programs available for women to compete among themselves. George Gangwer, the legal counsel for the NCAA, has made the statement that the association is charged with administering intercollegiate athletics for all member institutions, yet has no program for women, and in fact, does exclude them. As a member of the NCAA, Michigan State University has fostered similar discriminatory practices against women existing in their own programs. One such discriminatory practice is towards women's intercollegiate athletics. First of all, I would like to explain some of the inequities as known. Secondly, I would like to point out some recommendations for changes and request investigation of the total athletic program for women. In order to explain the existing situation of women's intercollegiate athletics on the Michigan State campus, it is necessary to investigate the basic budgetary divisions and to attain specific data about allocations to men's and women's programs within these divisions. It is my understanding that there are three divisions: intramural sports, which is under the Vice President for Student Affairs; Secondly, Academic Department of Health, Physical Education, and Recreation under the College of Education. And third, Intercollegiate Athletics under the Executive Vice President. It appears to me that while men and women's programs are funded under a singular budget in intramurals and the academic department, there is no funding of women's programs in the intercollegiate division, despite the fact that there are seven women's teams that represent Michigan State University in intercollegiate competition. Specifically, I want to mention that intercollegiate athletics division is only men's intercollegiate athletics, and women's intercollegiate athletics budget is drawn from health, physical education, and recreation academic department in the College of Education. For example, if you check the phone book, there's no separate listing for men and women's intercollegiate athletics. It would appear that intercollegiate athletics would include both, but it doesn't. Questions regarding discriminatory fundings must, of course, be directed in all areas of athletic programming. There are a number of inequities in women's athletics which can be identified from the deficiencies demonstrated by the present structure of the athletic program. The following are some examples of some of these inequities. First of all, students have to pay for their participation in women's intercollegiate athletics. For example, on the basketball team, Health, Physical Education, and Recreation Department will pay for only one part, the shirt, of a student's uniform. The responsibility for the remaining pieces of the uniform, their warm-up suits, their shoes, socks, pants, etc., rests with the student. In order to participate in women's intercollegiate athletics, the student must have a complete matching uniform. The inequity has been erased to some extent by the athletic department's approval of uniforms last week. The uniforms have not arrived yet, and the season's half over, but perhaps the uniforms will arrive by the end of the season. Another example of this is the basketball team and the volleyball team's season run simultaneously. There is only one shirt for one woman of both teams. A volleyball student will go to a game, wear the shirt, wash it, bring it back to the intramural building. Next day, come back, a basketball player will check out the shirt, wear it at the game, bring it back, and then the volleyball team player can use the shirt. If perhaps they both have a game on the same night, one team just has to wear t-shirts and pennies. That's the way it is. Secondly, there is not adequate funding for travel expenses. One recent example of this issue is the women's volleyball team request to attend the Nationals in Florida. The team attended the national tournament but has received no support from the athletic department and as a result has solicited to date $480 from donors and a remaining deficit of $1,000. The initial money for this trip was provided on a short-term basis by a woman. Another example of a lack of adequate funds for the women's intercollegiate athletics travel expenses is the current solicitation by Michigan State University women's swim team to attend the National Women's Intercollegiate Swim Meet. As discussed in the state news, the women's swim team is sponsoring a swimathon to raise this money. I wonder how many men's teams have had to sponsor swimathons. Third, a third issue demonstrating the existing inequities is a lack of adequate facilities for women's intercollegiate athletic events. It was not until students requested from Mr. Breslin better facilities such as new basketball bank boards, electric scoreboards, and relined floors that any action was taken. Other colleges have refused to permit their women's teams to participate in Michigan State University as a result of these poor facilities. Fourth, a fourth issue is that the time spent coaching by women faculty in the physical education department is not appropriately reflected by their salary. By this, I mean that the faculty receive the equivalent of only one credit hour for an entire season of coaching. Most men coaches have the faculty rank in the major sports. For example, the football coaches are given full professor, basketball and wrestling associate professor. While it appears that the men coaches teach one class, that class is in their sport, one might check whether the class is really taught by the coach or by a graduate teaching assistant. Whereas in the men coaches are hired as coaches under intercollegiate athletics. This can be found out by checking the budget. But in the women's section, there are no women's coaches. For example, no one's hired as a women's coach in the intercollegiate athletic teams. There seems to be no reason why women coaches are not hired under the Division of Intercollegiate Athletics, and no reason why women's intercollegiate athletic programs are not financed under the Division of Intercollegiate Athletics. A copy of the letter from Dr. Michaels, Women's Athletic Coordinator, which has been distributed to you, is evidence of the misconceptions of the place of women's athletics today. This is an example of the kind of leadership which is given to women here at Michigan State University. Dr. Michael states that until this year, there was no national program at all for women at all. In fact, the Women's National Association has been on record as being opposed to competition for women. This is untrue. Michigan State has had intercollegiate or interscholastic teams for more than a decade, swimming and tennis as the examples. The AIAW, the Association for Women's Intercollegiate Athletics for Women, has been in existence since 1966 and has member institutions and has a membership of 166 institutions. This organization is being used to promote athletic competition for women among colleges and universities. This would seem to verify that AIAW does promote competition for women. Intercollegiate competition or intercollegiate athletics for women is not only for women who are in the health, physical education, and recreation majors. Many participate from other majors. All represent Michigan State University. This support is not for professionalization, but for participation, recognition of skill and talent, reputation or representation of the university, development of spirit, character, and relationships with other schools. In the preceding part of this presentation, I have addressed the existing inequities and the discriminatory policies of the athletic divisions regarding women's athletics, more specifically, women's intercollegiate athletics. In the following statements, I would like to make several recommendations as possible steps to remedy these situations. First, women's intercollegiate athletics must be budgeted under intercollegiate athletics, not health, physical education, and recreation within the College of Education. Second, there should be increased appropriations for women's intercollegiate athletics, and these appropriations should include items such as coaches' salary and the team's travel expense. Third, the women's volleyball team should be reimbursed for their expenses for the national tournament held earlier this year. Fourth, there should be greater attention through programming regarding the use of existing facilities on campus for women's intercollegiate athletics. Although there have been some initial steps in improving women's facilities, these steps fall short of the types of implementation necessary for good women's intercollegiate program. For example, improved locker rooms, permission of the use of the intramural building, generally referred to as the men's intramural building, and Jennison Fieldhouse. Dr. Anderson has stated, "The men have bent over backwards for us now. They have been very cooperative. But have they really? Why do women have to fight for things like stopwatches for the swim team? Why did women have to keep score on a chalkboard and have no visual clock to play by in basketball? Would you call supplying necessities bending over backwards for you?" Fifth, there should be a general appraisal made of the entire women's intercollegiate programs. Because of the lack of foresight and leadership, Michigan State University has made little, if any, progress in the development of substantial women's intercollegiate programs. Sixth, a woman must immediately be put on the selection committee for the new athletic director. This person must be aware of the concerns of the new things happening in women's intercollegiate athletics. Also, a woman must be on the selection committee for the new women's athletic director. An athletic director who is sensitive to the needs and the concerns of women in physical education and women's intercollegiate sports. In conclusion, I would hope that the issues addressed and the recommendations which have been made will be implemented in the near future. I feel that Michigan State University could become a leader in the nation in women's intercollegiate athletic programs, and I would hope that by financial commitment would demonstrate that this is an important part of the development and planning for women on this campus.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The trustees would like to break for dinner. I would like to suggest that if there are those who have not yet appeared, who would not be able to appear this evening, if they would contact either Mr. Perrin or Ms. Foreman in the back of the room immediately to let us know that you would not be able to appear this evening so that we can put you in now. But we would like to break in the next 15 to 20 minutes for dinner. We will not be able to complete all of these until we come back afterwards. There are still, we've already heard some 15 out of the 27, and therefore we would have to have an evening session. We will continue for the moment with Mr. Edward Turdall, but if there are those of you who have not appeared, who are scheduled to appear this evening, if you cannot be here this evening, if you'd please contact Mr. Perrin or Ms. Foreman in the back. Mr. Turdall? I'm sorry, Ms. Bridget Denihan.
I'm an undergraduate of the Association of Women Students, and I'd like to speak about some of the concerns of undergraduate women. I'd like to raise some questions at this time. My first area of concern is the recruitment of women students. Are women actually encouraged to enter all colleges of the university through literature published by the university and through people representing the university?
Could you pull the mic a little closer?
Thank you. Better? Okay. Are women athletes sought in the same manner as men athletes are? Are they offered the same type of financial assistance? Are they sought in the same numbers as men athletes are? Upon acceptance to the university, are women encouraged to develop their talents to the fullest extent? Are they actually welcomed in classrooms as serious students? Are they regarded as intelligent people seeking adequate education by their academic advisors? Or are they sometimes seen as girls seeking good husbands? Are women encouraged to venture into non-traditional fields such as engineering and medicine? And once enrolled, are they encouraged to excel, or are they discouraged and channeled into such programs as teaching or nursing? Do women at Michigan State encounter other areas where attitudes against females may hinder their progress? Another area of concern is the lack of role models at Michigan State. Are women students exposed to a variety of female faculty members, administrators, and trustees who act as role models? Can women students see examples of successful women on campus to assist and encourage them in making valuable contributions to the community, as well as in realizing their own potentials? There is also the issue of the absence of leadership and resulting loss of identity of women students. Has Michigan State concerned itself with the disintegration of various women's organizations that have in the past provided some form of leadership for women in the university? An example of this might be the former Women's in the Residence Council. And finally, has Michigan State taken a position in support of women as a vital part of the community in practice as well as policy? Now I'd like to offer some suggestions as to what the university might do to answer some of these questions. Investigation of the possibility of discrimination against women as students, faculty members, and administrators in the areas of recruitment of students, academic advising, athletics, financial assistance, hiring and promotion practices, and all other areas where discrimination might be suspected. Investigate what Michigan State is doing for the as an influential institution to eliminate discrimination on the basis of sex in the community as a whole, in academic fields as well as in other fields. A decided effort by Michigan State to seek out and hire qualified women who set good examples of accomplishment for women undergraduates. And finally, the establishment of a women's advocate office to investigate future questions such as the ones that I've raised today.
Thank you. Thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you very much. Next, we have Mr. Edward Turdall, graduate student and president of the Married Students Union.
Ed Turdall, graduate student, and as was mentioned, president of the Married Students Union. I felt a little awkward, so I brought along some moral support. I'd like to mention some things informally first. One, that the Married Students Union is at the moment just an organization. We are, however, attempting to confront you at a later date in order to tackle the question of a major governing status for our group, representing married students as well as student spouses and children. I want to bring one thing to your attention, both to the board, to the president, and to you out here. And that is that our group is very concerned about many of the things that do relate to both women's equality as well as spouse equality. Specifically, this coming Tuesday evening at 7:30, our group, the Married Students Union, is having an open meeting at the daycare center in Spartan Village. And we are going to attempt to discuss some things about our recognition, about the types of goals that we are looking for. In addition, let me just bring up then these points. We have asked a number of people from subcommittee of the Family or Medical Referral Committee to discuss some things which are going on within the university and within the medical schools that might well relate to meeting some of the needs, health needs, of married students and spouses and children. And specifically, a Dr. Helfer and a Dr. Kirschbaum have been asked to make a presentation to our group. Along with this, representatives from the central administration and Office of Student Affairs, as well as the Institute for Family and Child Research, have been requested to come and either observe or make a presentation to our group as to how they see their relationship to us. And again, I add that this is an open meeting. We trust that all of you will realize the importance of your presence at this meeting, again at 7:30 this coming Tuesday at the daycare center. Judy Lewis, at my right here, is a member of our board, and as a member of our board, is representative and chairman to the student faculty board of the daycare center, and she's going to present our prepared statement.
Thank you. The Married Students Union has long been concerned with the lack of health services available to spouses and children of students. We feel it is necessary that the Board of Trustees aid and cooperate with the married students and the medical schools in the establishment of health care facilities for students and their families. We especially support the Alliance in these requests. One, the establishment of a well child clinic. Two, acute care facilities should be established on campus for all students, spouses, and children on campus. Three, medical counseling facilities should be available to all students, faculty, spouses, and children. Four, prenatal care and delivery facilities must be developed. Five, expectant parent classes should be continuously provided on campus along with infant care classes. Six, fees must be such that they do not exclude any student families in time of need. Seven, the family planning clinic should be encouraged and expanded in order to better serve the entire student community. The Married Students Union pledges all possible support and cooperation in the achievement of these goals. Thank you.
Are there any questions from any of the trustees? Thank you very much. There is one person who cannot appear this evening after we reconvene at 7, who has asked for an occasion to present views at the present time, Eleanor Morrison, instructor in the Department of Family and Child Sciences.
I'm going to speak very briefly before the guillotine of dinner falls, but I wanted to speak in person because I see the things that I'm concerned about as being pertinent not only to women, but to men. And I'd like to speak about the tenure system as it relates to part-time faculty. And since the part-time faculty is largely composed of a woman's component, I speak at this woman's hearing. In recent years, there has been increasing uneasiness about the tenure system as it presently operates in many departments in the university. Understandably, it grew up to protect faculty against arbitrary attacks from within and from without the university, and to ensure promotion on the basis of merit. However, as educational and societal factors have changed, the tenure system has persisted relatively unchanged and unchanging. The criticism which I would like to level affects not only women, also men, who are part-time faculty people. As presently operationalized, the tenure system denies, or almost denies, staff benefits such as retirement, hospitalization, and promotion to any who are not full-time faculty members. It is rarely possible to achieve a rank beyond that of instructor if a faculty member is not in the tenure stream, no matter how qualified or competent. And it is not possible to be in the tenure stream, or almost impossible, unless working on a full-time basis as a faculty member. Therefore, the system operates to keep the lowest paid, lowest status people frozen in their position, regardless of competence, if they're not full-time. There are logical and defensible reasons within the academic community for these rules and for this system, of which I'm well aware, as I'm sure you are, and they were appropriate at the time they were enacted. However, recent developments and current and future trends raise questions which point to the necessity of review. There is at the present time, as you know, I'm sure, a severe shortage of faculty openings around the country, even for well-qualified PhDs. Stories abound of men and women with doctorates who are teaching in junior high schools and elsewhere in clerical jobs. Under such circumstances, the tenure system, which requires full-time employment as a requisite for tenure, means that many competent and well-qualified persons will either be denied full citizenship in the professorial community or will seek employment outside the university community where they can be guaranteed some security. A revision of tenure rules to cover the possibility of part-time faculty would mean a great deal in the sense, make a great deal of sense in today's situation. Two competent faculty people might share one job, and anyone who's ever had a half-time job knows that half-time people often spend more than half-time on their jobs, so the university be getting a bargain. But those two people would have the rights, security, benefits, and the possibility of promotion now denied them. In such a situation, the tenure system appears like a closed union, stringently maintaining the club rules. Half-time or even three-quarter-time faculty members are treated almost as non-existent in terms of rights, benefits, promotion, and status. A further irony in the situation is the increasing number of young men and women who choose not to work full-time. They see some of the crying needs of our communities and some of the much neglected priorities of our national life as worthy of their time and effort, and they're willing to devote part of their time and energy to those non-work tasks which urgently need to be done in our democracy. But if their profession happens to be university teaching, it is not possible to attain citizenship in the university community with tenure and work less than full time. Women are increasingly going to work, including young women with young children. The present employment situation in the university militates against such a woman working part time and devoting another part of her time and energy to the family or community service. Many of our most sensitive and capable young people today are seriously concerned to invest their lives in service and improvement of the quality of life in our communities. They would like also to have their profession be that of university teaching. If tenure rules were flexible enough, it would be possible to invite these bright, socially concerned youth into the ranks of the faculty with full citizenship rights there, while encouraging them also to use their brains and skills for the genuine improvement of our nation. Universities talk about the importance of the university being involved in the world, down with the ivory tower, but the reality of the tenure system necessitates work done in the world being done on overtime rather than in prime time. Young women, and men also, who are concerned about the future of the family hope to invest considerable time in the family, and it needs it. Sharing between the parents the nurture and training of children while sharing between the parents two part-time jobs, possibly. A recent study of Harvard graduates indicated that the brightest graduates were less concerned with money that they could make than with the contribution they could make to society. If the tenure system could be reconsidered so that it could benefit persons who want to invest time in family and community, as well as in the university, it might make a radical difference both in the quality of teaching in the university and also in the quality of life in our nation. In many quarters in our society, there is a pressure for flexibility of employment hours to enable full utilization of persons unable or unwilling for a variety of reasons to be employed on a full-time basis. To summarize, the tenure system as presently operative seems to be indicating that quantitative commitment is a measure of qualitative service to the academic community. My testimony is intended to raise questions about that assumption. Thank you.
Thank you. Do any trustees have any questions or comments?
I'd like
Trustee Huff?
To ask Ms. Morrison, has this been a subject of any discussion that you know of with the within the American Association of University Professors?
I'm sorry, I don't know that, and I should.
Well, I should know it too, but I don't.
Any other questions? If not, thank you very much. We will reconvene at 7 o'clock. We will reconvene at 7 o'clock. Okay. I would like to reconvene the hearing, which we recessed for a dinner break. I understand that Rosa Suarez will not make a presentation, but will be substituted for by Guadalupe Solis. Is that correct?
Is she?
Would you like to wait? All right. Would you mind if we went on to somebody else and then came back to the full group? All right, fine. Margaret Bullboats, is she here? Bubbles. Okay, Verna Hildebrand.
President Horton, members of the Board of Trustees, and administrators and friends. Thank you for the opportunity to present the case for equality for women at Michigan State University. On the one hand, the holding of this hearing is evidence of genuine leadership and progress at Michigan State. On the other hand, it is a sad commentary on the state of affairs that the oldest land-grant university in the United States, which is philosophically committed to helping everyone, still finds in the year 1972 that a meeting of this kind is necessary. Probably all of you individually, and certainly officially in a brochure titled Anti-Discrimination Policy and Procedures, have been on record for some time with beautiful rhetoric in support of equality for all. After nearly two centuries, the noble principles of the Declaration of Independence and of the U.S. Constitution have yet to be extended to women, especially to minority women, at Michigan State. Let us look at a few of the current practices on the MSU campus to note the gap between enunciated principle and actual deeds. Frankly, at this point, I proceed with great trepidation because women, like blacks and Chicanos, have always feared the power structure. Like blacks and Chicanos, we have been socialized to know our place, to fit in with smiles, and to ask no disturbing questions. I suspect that without Dr. Patricia Kerrigan's path-breaking election to the Board of Trustees, the women of this community would not have had the courage to press for a meeting of this kind or to speak with any meaningful degree of candor. To view the impact of Dr. Kerrigan's election with historical perspective, may I remind you that discrimination of women has been so atrocious that women were not even permitted to vote until about 50 years ago. However, the impact of the awakening of the American woman may be sufficient this year to achieve for the first time the selection of large numbers of women as delegates to political conventions. Obviously, there is a ray of hope that women will soon have voting strength in those conventions equal to their proportion in the population. While I still have the courage, let me proceed to list a few of the current practices of sex discrimination on this campus. Number one, not many months ago, about a 7% faculty pay raise was distributed. To my knowledge, no effort was made to help women attain human dignity, that is, to receive equal pay for equal work. Next time, let's first set aside sufficient funds to increase women's salaries to equal those of comparable male colleagues across the campus. Number two, more recently, requests have been made through channels to help reduce, not remove, some glaring inequities with respect to women's salaries. I understand the answer at Central Administration has been no. How does a no convert into a yes, we're active in removing inequities at MSU? Three, a few months ago, the College of Human Ecology, which is celebrating its 75th year of distinguished services to the citizens of Michigan, had a dean candidate on campus, a nationally prominent woman. We could not entice her to consider the position. Apparently, one reason was because the salary range discussed was that for a woman dean, not that of male deans on campus. She was unwilling to accept a big reduction in salary. Number four. Human Ecology is still searching for a dean. The Department of Family Ecology is searching for a chairman. Honorable trustees, may we be authorized to offer salaries to women candidates equivalent to what men deans and chairmen get on this campus? Number five, all but the blind sexes can see by glancing at the salary schedule, which was distributed by the Bob Repas Committee for a Rational Pay Policy, that not only does human ecology